the leadership of the countries, and particularly we're talking about largely neocolonial states, states that are just having to be subservient to international finance capital, have all the trappings of independence, but they really are governed and manipulated by outside. And then there's the masses of the people on the ground who have a different reaction and who really, you know, are expressing whatever they can. So we have to make that distinction. On the ground, we have people who demonstrated about, you know, against these types of things and demonstrating in a lot of ways in for different aspects against this war that's taking place.
African students formally appear to be welcoming to Ukraine and injected millions of dollars into the country's economy, but have now realized that they were truly not perceived as equal, but inferior by whites in this country. Now, Mr. Freeman, what lessons can Africans learn from this form of racism?
I think the lesson in it is that white supremacy is a global phenomenon, and it is also about power. And that we have to fight for power in this world, the power dispositions regarding the economic dispositions and political dispositions, how much we can control our own, you know, we have self-determination. That's what we have to fight for, and we have to do it in a mass. And we have to realize that we're in a global struggle against white supremacy and international finance capital, against the rest of collective humanity.
The International Day for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination is observed annually on 21st of March. Despite such a day being marked globally, we are still witness to shocking incidents of racial discrimination.
Now, our last question to you, Mr. Freeman, is the so-called international community paying lip service to the struggle against racism?
I think it's very interesting in the sense that even as the question is posed, there's a sort of an underlining acknowledgement that when we say international community, we're really talking about the Western countries, Western leadership, you know, Western European countries, rather. And so the international community has to come to be redefined. It's going to be only paying lip service to these things because the Western world's preeminence and its supremacy in the world is dependent on racial discrimination and those type of things. So it can only pay lip service to it. And so we have to come to redefine what international community means in a way so that it doesn't refer to the Western European elite, and that it becomes redefined through a people-centered process and struggle for self-determination and for socialism. And so we have to have that.
Now, that's an interesting perspective indeed. We need to redefine what really comprises of the international community. Thanks a lot, Mr. Freeman, for your incisive analysis. And I'll take a short break. When we come back, we shall be talking about the transatlantic slave trade. Stay with us.
Remembering slavery.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
For over 400 years, nearly 20 million men, women, and children from Africa were the victims of the tragic transatlantic slave trade, one of the darkest chapters in human history. Now, this criminal trade was officially carried out by European colonial powers. In commemoration of the memory of the victims, the General Assembly of the United Nations on the 17th December 2007 declared the 25th of March as the International Day of Remembrance of the Victims of Slavery and the Transatlantic Slave Trade, to be observed annually.
The resolution also called for the establishment of a program to mobilize educational institutions, civil society, and other organizations to inculcate in future generations the causes, consequences, and lessons of the transatlantic slave trade, and to communicate the dangers of racism and prejudice. This year, the President of the United Nations General Assembly, Abdullah Shahid, visited the Ark of Return, the United Nations permanent memorial to honor the victims of slavery and the transatlantic slave trade.
Now, during his visit to this memorial site, which also stands testimony as a reminder that racism has no place in the world, he recalled his visit to Senegal's Gori Island.
Years ago, I visited Gori Island in Senegal, which was the largest slave trading center on the African coast from the 15th to the 19th century. I saw the small spaces, imagining the crowded rooms where the enslaved persons were picked. I will never forget the feeling of sorrow and distress, thinking on those who went through the very small door overlooking the Atlantic Ocean.
Now, for more on the remembrance of the inhuman transatlantic slave trade perpetrated by Western colonial powers, we contacted P.L.O. Lumumba, a renowned Pan-Africanist and academic. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Now, our first question, do you think the transatlantic slave trade is given the attention it deserves in Africa and the Americas?
I don't think so. I think whatever attention we give it is merely salutary. One would have expected that an event as devastating as it was is given attention which is continental. One would have expected that there is a day that is dedicated in all African countries to remember that unfortunate trade. But that does not happen. In fact, one can say that the commemoration is left to a few public-spirited individuals, and it barely gets mentioned in many African countries, which is tragic in itself.
The British royal couple visited Jamaica from March 22 to 24 this year in order to commemorate Queen Elizabeth's Platinum Jubilee. This was just before the International Day of Remembrance of the Victims of Slavery and the Transatlantic Slave Trade. The visit was met by protests from Jamaicans demanding an apology and reparations from Britain over its leading role in slave trade.
To us, for these young people to be here to try to persuade us to keep the status quo in place when our goal is to loosen and remove the hands, the gloved hands of the Queen from around our necks so that we can breathe.
Now, Mr. Lumumba, what's your take on this visit, especially considering that Britain's royal family was deeply involved in colonialism and the slave trade?
Remember that the British monarch, particularly the current monarch, was present when colonialism was alive and well. And it saddens me that she is given the accolades which she does not deserve by those whose parents and those whose ancestors were traumatized and victimized by slavery. It is a case of selective amnesia on both sides. The monarch pretends that there was no slavery, the monarch pretends that there was no colonization, and the people also behave as if there was no slavery and no colonization. I think we should speak unanimously and tell the monarch that until there is an unequivocal apology from the British government, they will never be given the accolade that they so much crave for.
While slave trade helped turn America and Western European countries into economic giants they are today, Many like these Jamaicans here protesting a visit by members of Britain's royal family are demanding an apology and reparations.
Respect us, man. Apologize now.
Sending a shout out to the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge and the entire royal family that reparation time come now.
Isn't it about time that European countries involved in the evil slave trade apologize and pay reparations to Africa, just like they are doing to alleged victims of Holocaust?
Without doubt, you'd have seen in my previous answer, I've talked about slavery as if it were colonization, because in my view, slavery is really colonization, is slavery turned inside out. And in direct answer to your question, I'm saying that we deserve reparations. We don't ask for it. We don't act as a team as Africans. We are still victims of divide and rule. Your typical African leader, still, if they were colonized by the British or by the French or the Portuguese or the Germans or the Italians, still behave as if they are beholden to those countries. And that is why we can't speak with one voice.
Despite the so-called abolition of slavery in the United States, African Americans continue to suffer institutional racism, and the brutal murder of George Floyd is just an example of what people of African descent endure every day in America. Clearly, racism still lingers in the United States.
George Floyd is simply emblematic of what happens on a daily basis, and I think that it is incumbent upon us to keep speaking about and against it, because if we don't, it will continue to gain roots in subterranean and subtle ways.
The only known existing autobiography of an African slave in America was written in Arabic by Omar ibn Said. This autobiography debunked myths that enslaved Africans had no culture or civilization. How does the story of Omar ibn Said tell us about the distortion of the history of African Americans?
The history of Africa has always been distorted, and if you want to see the dramatization of this unfortunate situation, Alex Haley's Roots dramatizes the modus operandi of the slave master. First of all, they took away your language, they dehumanized you, they humiliated you, they erased your history, and they claimed that your life only started when you were enslaved. You did not know how to write, you did not think, you were simply one who had a human form, but you are not a human being, you are not a thinking being. And that continues to be perpetuated even today. And the time has come for Africans to begin to ask certain fundamental questions. Why is it that they destroyed the museums which were found in different parts of Africa? Why is it that they erased our history? And we too have an obligation to make it known to the world that we had a history.
Over the recent past, there have been reports of continued slavery in different parts of the world. Now, Mr. Lumumba, can you elaborate on this phenomenon?
You know, in my view, slavery has always metamorphosized. When the Western world recognized that slavery was no longer sustainable, it went into the next stage, which was colonization. And when colonization was no longer tenable and sustainable, it has transformed into the neo-colonial project. And that is not to say that classical slavery has ended. We know that slavery is going on in different parts of the world, in the Sahelian region, slavery is alive and well. In different parts of Europe, slavery is still alive and well. But latter-day slavery is of an economic kind. We are so beholden to the erstwhile colonizer, the erstwhile slave master, and we do not know, and even if we do not know, we are not conscious of its very pervasive character. Today, the African economies are simply marionettes controlled from European capitals, which can be switched off without a notice.
Okay, Mr. Lumumba, our final question to you. What needs to be done to eliminate or eradicate these forms of economic slavery you just talked about?
African countries should work as a team, and there have been efforts in that direction, beginning with the Lagos Plan of Action of 1980. I now see the Africa Continental Free Trade Area. That is an initiative which would address the economic slavery and colonization that we still labor under. It is also important that Africans remove tariff and non-tariff barriers and allow their citizens to move across the continent without these impediments.
Thank you very much, Mr. PLO Lumumba, for your insight. Now, as our guest said, the African countries need to emancipate themselves from economic slavery that continues to be perpetrated by Western imperialist powers. And that brings us to the end of yet another edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. It was great having you, and goodbye for now.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we would like to examine a very important and pertinent question. And that question is about the etiquettes of the recitation of the Holy Quran. As you know, this is the month of Ramadan. And, you know, the month of Ramadan is a month in which the Quran was revealed. We have been asked to recite the Quran as much as we can in this holy month. And so this question is very pertinent for us today and in the time that we're in. So we can categorize the etiquettes of the recitation of the Holy Quran into two categories. There are certain apparent physical etiquettes, and then there are certain spiritual etiquettes as well. And both of them, you know, there should be taken into consideration when reciting the Holy Quran. One of the etiquettes, let's start with the apparent etiquettes and see if we can finish them and get to the spiritual etiquettes as well. One of the basic etiquettes of recitation of the Holy Quran is what we call taharat or ritual purity. And that is that, you know, if we want to, obviously, it's true that if you don't touch the actual words of the Holy Quran, then it's not necessary to be in a state of ritual purity, meaning being in a state of having wuzu, not being, in a state of janabat and these kind of things. But if we are required to touch it, yes, this is a requirement. But if we want to reap the spiritual, you know, benefits of the whole recitation, yes, we should be in a state of taharat, One of the other etiquettes of the recitation of the Holy Quran is what we call isti'aza. Isti'aza means that we seek refuge in God from the insinuations of the devil and shaitan before we begin the recitation of the Holy Quran. Right? For example, we read the following in the Holy Quran: فَإِذَا قَرَعْتَ الْقُرْآنَ فَاسْتَعِذْ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ. is a famous verse of the Holy Quran. When you want to recite the Holy Quran, take refuge in God from the accursed, which is Satan. Right? So this is the second etiquette of the Holy Quran. Right, these are two of the very apparent etiquettes of the Holy Quran. Now let's turn to a little bit about, look at the spiritual etiquettes of the Holy Quran. One of the basic spiritual etiquettes is paying attention to the Holy Quran, having our heart present, right? As we say in Arabic, the qalb or the heart should be hadir, it should be present, right? How do we know that our heart is present? When we reflect on the Holy Quran, we do tadabbur on the Holy Quran, and we think about its verses, right? Which is basically the purpose of the Holy Quran. Because God Almighty says, Kitabun anzalnahu ilayka mubarakun layaddabbaru ayateh. Right? The purpose of the Holy Quran, God Almighty says, this is the book which we revealed to you, meaning the Prophet. It's blessed so that the people may reflect on it. Right? So reflection and thinking about the Holy Quran, doing tadabbur and thinking about it, is another etiquette and a requirement of reflecting on the Holy Quran. So we shouldn't try to, this month of Ramadan, let's see how many Qurans we can finish in this month. That's not necessary. Rather, we should try to, when we recite the Holy Quran, it doesn't matter how many verses we recite, but we should, the ones we recite, we should think about and reflect upon them while we are reciting them. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the etiquettes of reciting the Holy Quran in the light of the Holy Quran's verses. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
In the limelight.
People who need insulin shouldn't have to break the bank just to survive, but in the US they often do, said a researcher with Human Rights Watch. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Report Says Cruel and Regressive US Insulin Prices Violate Human Rights. Here's more. Insulin prices in the United States of America are so high that a new report published recently characterizes them as a violation of human rights, one that has had deadly consequences for diabetes without the means to afford the medicine. In a detailed report titled, If I'm Out of Insulin, I'm Going to Die, United States Lack of Regulation Fuels Crisis of Unaffordable Insulin, Human Rights Watch, HRW, makes the case that both the federal government and the pharmaceutical industry are badly failing to live up to their human rights responsibilities. Unlike the healthcare systems of other major countries, Medicare in the U.S. is barred by law from negotiating drug prices directly with pharmaceutical companies, which, as a result, have tremendous leeway to like too high costs and pad their bottom lines. Recent legislative attempts to allow direct price negotiation have collapsed due to aggressive industry lobbying and opposition from pharma-friendly lawmakers. Matt McConnell, economic justice and rights researcher at HRW, said people who need insulin shouldn't have to break the bank just to survive, but in the U.S. they often do. Since the U.S. doesn't regulate drug prices or ensure adequate coverage for insulin costs, countless people who can't afford expensive insulin are not only straining their financial resources, but paying with their health, lives, and livelihoods. In an analysis of publicly available data, HRW found that the U.S. pharmaceutical giant Eli Lilly has increased the list price for Humalog, a commonly used insulin product, by an inflation-adjusted 680% since it started selling the drug in 1996. The list price of a vial of Humalog was $275 in 2018, HRW observed. The U.S. list price of Novo Nordisk's Novolog, meanwhile, rose about 403% to roughly $289 per vial between 2000 and 2018, according to HRW. Such exorbitant prices, which far exceed the relatively low cost of producing insulin, often force diabetes in the U.S. to ration their doses or trek across the border into Canada, where insulin prices are far lower. HRW noted recently that nearly every one of the 50 insulin-dependent people interviewed for the new report said they had rationed analog insulin because of out-of-pocket cost, taking it in ways not recommended by their physician in order to stretch their supply. Diabetes affects more than 37 million U.S. adults and is the country's seventh leading cause of death, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Emily Grant, a 29-year-old with diabetes, told HRW, "We are the wealthiest country in the world, but people have to go without medication. There is nothing I can do about the trajectory of my illness except follow the treatment plans my doctors tell me. And I don't think it's okay to say, oh, well, you either afford it or you die." HRW argues that the U.S. government's continued failure to constrain soaring prices undermines equal and affordable access to insulin analogs and contravenes the right to health. The group points out that the U.S. is a signatory too, but has not yet ratified the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, which affirms the right of everyone to the enjoyment of the highest attainable standard of physical and mental health. The report also stresses that pharmaceutical companies have a responsibility under the United Nations Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights to respect human rights and ensure that their practices do not cause or contribute to human rights abuses. Our system of unregulated and often unmitigated high drug prices is cruel and regressive and has allowed companies to gouge some of the most vulnerable people in the country for a product they cannot live without, McConnell said, but we have the tools to fix this crisis. Among HRW's policy recommendations is federal legislation guaranteeing that essential medications such as insulin are affordable to all who need them, no matter their income, insurance, or citizenship status.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This is A to Z. An Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Today's lesson, the moral level of fasting. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. Brothers and sisters, according to one classification, there are three levels explained for someone who keeps a fast. The first one is the basic level of fasting, the second one is the moral level of fasting, and the third one is the spiritual level of fasting. Now, this moral level of fasting, which is the second level, is something we would like to discuss today. This is a level above the basic level. In this level, the person does not refrain from things forbidden in the list of muftirat, which are things that invalidate fasting, he or she also refrains from misuse or wrong use of the other faculties of the body, such as tongue, the eyes, the hands, the feet, and so on and so forth. In the words of the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, this is the fasting of the tongue and other limbs. When a person elevates his fast to the moral level, he has not only protected the self from punishment, but also attained the reward or the thawab promised by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. See how it is truly the next level? The basic level was what? That you are just not going to be thrown into hellfire for not carrying out an obligatory act. You're not going to be punished. It just gets you off the hook. And you're doing the bare minimum, the bare bones, the very basic level of fasting, right? But the second level, the moral level, it is something that, you know, now you have a guarantee from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that you're going to attain reward and thawab as promised by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So this truly is the next level of fasting. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are talking about the three levels of fasting, the basic level, the moral level, and the spiritual level. We have explained to you the basic level, the moral level too. We started explaining to you that in addition to not being thrown into the hellfire and not have to go through the punishment, in addition to all this, you also get reward in the hereafter. This is the moral level of fasting. And what was the difference? Well, of course, that in addition to some of the limbs, you be careful of your other limbs too, like your eyes, like your ears, like your hands, like your feet, so on and so forth, that they are in obedience to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Look at the 10 items in the list of muftirat, those things that invalidate your fast.
9 of them are related to physical desires or the bodily aspects of our being. 1 of them deals with the speech, which means falsely ascribing a statement to Allah and the infallibles. This last and unusual item is worth our consideration. It is not only ascribing a false statement to Allah and the infallible ones forbidden haram, lying and uttering a false statement is haram in general, but only the former invalidates the fast, while the latter does not. This is a window from the ritual or the basic level of fasting into the moral level. Referring to this level of fasting, Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam said, "Fasting is not only about food and drink that a person refrains from eating or drinking. In reality, when you fast, then your ears, your eyes, your tongue, your stomach, and your private parts must also fast. Restrain your hand and your private parts from haram, and mostly maintain silence except for something good, and be lenient towards your servants." Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
The Biden administration is ignoring desperate pleas from humanitarian organizations and UN human rights bodies, choosing instead to maintain policies virtually guaranteed to cause mass starvation and death of civilians, especially children. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jake Batinga Ryder. This article is published under the heading, "U.S. Sanctions Caused Mass Civilian Deaths in Iraq. Afghan Civilians Are Up Next." Stay tuned, please. One million Afghan children may die from starvation over the next several months, according to the United Nations. Nearly 23 million Afghans are facing crisis levels of hunger, and 8.7 million are on the brink of starvation. This mass hunger has rendered millions of Afghans on the verge of death, according to the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. Alongside looming mass starvation, Afghans face below-freezing temperatures, severe shortages of life-saving medical supplies, and extreme poverty, making conditions in Afghanistan among the gravest of human rights crises on Earth. This is not a natural disaster, nor is it the result of conflict internal to Afghanistan. This is a human-made humanitarian catastrophe, United States-made specifically. The U.S.-allied Afghan government, most recently under the rule of Ashraf Ghani, was heavily dependent on foreign aid. Following the Taliban takeover in mid-August 2021, the Biden administration and the UN Security Council instituted devastating sanctions, sharply reducing foreign aid. The Biden administration froze $9.5 billion worth of Afghanistan's foreign currency reserves, roughly equivalent to 40% of the country's gross domestic product. Journalist Ryan Grimm and Sarah Sirota recently reported that the White House has urged European partners and multilateral institutions like the World Bank and International Monetary Fund to similarly starve the nation of capital. This has led to the total collapse of Afghanistan's economy, creating an almost globally unprecedented level of economic shock. Unemployment has skyrocketed, and the country's healthcare infrastructure has been decimated. As experts have noted, more Afghans are poised to die from U.S. sanctions over the next few months alone than have died at the hands of the U.S. military forces over the last 20 years combined, by a significant margin. Yet, as journalist Murtaza Hussein recently wrote, U.S. establishment politicians and intellectuals who decried the humanitarian crisis during the fall of Kabul are seemingly unbothered by imminent mass starvation imposed by the U.S. The Biden administration is ignoring desperate pleas from humanitarian organizations and UN human rights bodies, choosing instead to maintain policies virtually guaranteed to cause mass starvation and death of civilians, especially children. Yet it is important to note and remember that as a member and matter of policy, this is not particularly new. The U.S. has often imposed harsh economic sanctions, causing mass civilian death. A previous imposition of sanctions resulted in one of the worst humanitarian catastrophes, one largely forgotten in mainstream historical memory. In 1990, the U.S. imposed sanctions on Iraq through the UN following the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. These sanctions continued for more than a decade after Iraq withdrew from Kuwait and had horrific humanitarian consequences, eerily similar to the imminent mass starvation of Afghan civilians. The sanctions regime against Iraq, which began under George H.W. Bush, but was primarily administered by Bill Clinton's administration, froze Iraq's foreign assets, virtually banned trade, and sharply limited reports. These sanctions crashed the Iraqi economy and blocked the import of humanitarian supplies, medicine, food, and other basic necessities, killing scores of civilians. The international diplomat, Nobel Peace Prize laureate, and former Finnish president, Martti Ahtisaari, led the first UN delegation to Iraq shortly after the imposition of sanctions. The delegation reported that nothing that we had seen or read had quite prepared us for the particular form of devastation which has now befallen the country, unquote. The sanctions had produced near apocalyptic results. 2 years later, the World Food Program reported that the continuing sanctions had virtually paralyzed the whole economy and generated persistent deprivation, chronic hunger, endemic undernutrition, massive unemployment, and widespread human suffering. A grave humanitarian tragedy is unfolding, unquote. The consequences of the sanctions for Iraq's healthcare system were dramatic. Journalist Jeremy Schill extensively covered Iraq under these sanctions and reported that every pediatric hospital felt like a death row for infants. Highly trained Iraqi doctors had the knowledge to save these infants, but the sanctions blocked them from acquiring basic medical supplies and pharmaceuticals, forcing doctors to reuse syringes multiple times and ultimately watch children die of perfectly treatable ailments. Iraqi hospitals reeked of gasoline, Schill recalled, since desperate doctors were forced to substitute gasoline for sterilizer, disinfectant, and bleach. UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Iraq, Dennis Halliday, resigned his post in protest of the sanctions after serving as a UN diplomat for more than 30 years. During his resignation, he told the press that 4,000 to 5,000 children are dying unnecessarily every month due to the impact of sanctions because of the breakdown of water and sanitation, inadequate diet, and the bad internal health situation. He went on to label the U.S. imposed sanctions as genocide. His successor, German diplomat Hans von Sponeck, also resigned in protest after fewer than 2 years, calling the sanctions a true human tragedy that needs to be ended. A report by the UN Commission on Human Rights studying the impact of the sanctions on Iraq estimated the civilian death toll to be in the range from 500,000 to 1.5 million, with the majority of the dead being children. Clinton's Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, was confronted with this shocking statistic on 60 Minutes, which led to this now infamous exchange. During this era of sanctions, then Senator Joe Biden was a member and eventually chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Senator Biden strongly supported sanctions and advocated for even more aggressive policies toward Iraq. Biden was not then and is not now known for his humanitarian impulses or dovish foreign policy stances. The same cannot be said for Samantha Power. Power is the current head of the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, who was brought into the Biden administration to be a champion of human rights, lifting up the vulnerable and ushering in a new era of human progress and development, according to Biden's nomination statement. Power was the founding director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard, served as the Obama administration's UN ambassador, and has a long list of human rights accolades. The nomination of this human rights crusader, as Politico put it, was widely praised in the human rights community, yet Power's record on U.S. imposed sanctions, first in scholarship and then practice, is abysmal. In her Pulitzer Prize-winning book, A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide describes the U.S. response to genocides of the 20th century, arguing that U.S. power should have been used to prevent atrocities and protect civilians. In the chapter surveying the 1990s, Power condemns the Clinton administration's failure to intervene in Rwanda, intervene soon enough in the Balkans, and use U.S. military force to curb atrocities elsewhere. Yet the U.S. sanctions regime that caused mass devastation to Iraqi civilians was conspicuously absent. It does not get a single mention in the book. Power's silence on the hundreds of thousands of children dead from U.S. sanctions is telling. Power is unrelenting, and rightfully so, in her condemnation of human rights abuses carried out by other countries. Yet even though the death toll of the U.S. imposed sanctions rivaled or even exceeded the contemporaneous atrocities and genocides Power depicted in her book, when the U.S. was the perpetrator, she was silent. Unfortunately, her silence on sanctions and their devastating human consequences persist. Power, as administrator of USAID, is now an active participant in the starvation of Afghan civilians. In response to the pleas from the UN and humanitarian organizations working in Afghanistan, USAID increased humanitarian aid. But, as experts have noted, meagerly increasing aid while imposing devastating sanctions and freezing nearly all of Afghanistan's foreign assets will do nearly nothing to stop the unprecedented level of economic shock. There is near consensus among numerous humanitarian coordinators that the only way to curb the collapse of Afghanistan's economy and prevent feathering the major humanitarian disaster already underway is to lift the sanctions. Unfortunately, Power, the so-called defender of human rights, refuses to call for a lifting of the sanctions and instead remains uncritical. The devastating human toll of sanctions on Iraqi civilians in the 90s is a grim warning for what lies ahead if current U.S. policy continues. The Clinton administration sanctions caused mass deaths and suffering, and the Biden administration is dangerously close to falling in their footsteps. The human rights hawks, who lamented the humanitarian consequences of the fall of Kabul, are now silent in the face of U.S.-imposed mass starvation, and the human rights crusader within the administration is complicit. We must listen to the chorus of humanitarian organizations and pressure the Biden administration to immediately lift the sanctions before it is too late. Afghans have suffered at the hands of U.S. for long enough.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on March 10th, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the ninth session of the Assembly. There is a well-known sentence in the Commander of Faithful's letter to Malik al-Ashtar. Imam Ali Salam tells him to employ people with such and such characteristics. He mentions certain qualities and says that Malik must choose, as his colleagues, people with those qualities. After mentioning those qualities, he says, "You should have a piercing eye in this matter, because this religion has formerly been a prisoner in the hands of vicious persons." This is astonishing. The Commander of the Faithful says this to Malik al-Ashtar 20-plus years after the Holy Prophet's demise. This is a reference to the domination of Bani Umayyad and the like. They were people who would pronounce morning prayers with 4-6 rak'ats instead of 2. And after that, they would say, "We were well, we feel great. If you wish, we can even say longer prayers for you." They are the manifestation of this, because this religion has formerly been a prisoner in the hands of vicious persons.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
When action was taken according to passion and worldly wealth was sought, Such individuals use religion as a tool for achieving wealth and realizing their selfish desires. We, whether ourselves or our people, seek shelter in God, the Exalted, and ask Him to protect us from these hard snares set by the Satan. I hope that we ourselves will listen to this advice first, and that it will influence others as well. Dear God, by the blessedness of Muhammad and his household, make this month a blessed month for the entire Islamic Ummah and for the dear Iranian nation. Dear God, make the holy heart of the Imam of the Age satisfied and pleased with us. Help us benefit from the prayers and the satisfaction of the great personality, and send our greetings and regards to him as well. Greetings be upon you and God's mercy and blessings.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Millions of EU citizens are really starting to feel the pinch. Inflation in the 19-country eurozone is currently at 7.5%. The European Central Bank, ECB, wants inflation to be at just below 2%. It means the cost of living is out of control.
The impact of the war on the economy will depend on how the conflict evolves, on the effect of current sanctions, and on possible further measures.
On Thursday, the ECB said energy prices have increased by 45% in the past 12 months. Business and consumer confidence has fallen through the floor due to the conflict in Ukraine and sanctions against Russia. There are major supply issues. The cost of living is rising, but wages are not, according to the ECB. We have been speaking to EU citizens.
We have also a lot of refugees in Poland, so it's also a huge problem now for our country, for the healthcare system and every other area.
We have to take the car, we're trying to take everybody at the same place and try to share with other peoples, and of course everything in the food also. I mean, it's a big problem, yeah.
When I drive with a car or something and the prices went so high, as a student I cannot pay it.
If the Ukrainian conflict continue, there will be problem because Russian and Ukraine are two of the most important food producers, so there will be problem about food price.
And as a business person, are you worried about losing your business?
Yeah, it's stopping if you don't have the parts to construct your thing.
The next update from the European Central Bank is scheduled to take place on the 9th of June. So how badly could things possibly deteriorate for EU citizens between now and then? To quote the head of the bank, Christine Lagarde, who knows? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Memorial service is held to pay tribute to a major figure in the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, late Lieutenant General Mohammad Hejazi. Hejazi was the deputy commander of the IRGC's Quds Force, which is in charge of conducting overseas operations. The top general died last year after years of battling the effects of exposure to chemical agents in Iraqi gas attacks during the 1980s Iran-Iraq War.
General Hejazi was on the front line of the fight against the occupying Israeli regime. He was highly skilled in scouting for and training members of the resistance. The likes of